few more cups.
I would like to come in and read the word of God. Now look, if you are on your way to heaven, and I am on the way to hell, what do you think?
We'll do it live! Fuck it! Do it live! I'll write it and we'll do it live! And thing sucks!
And WBAI, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schneeb is brilliant and R. Paul Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. That's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
All I know is it's time to move along to our lost episode of Gene Shepherd. And it's not the program that Mr. Golden has an explanation and description of. So I'm not even clear. According to my notes and my files, this is the program of February 24th, 1966. Camp Shep, that's our world. A title strictly Rudy, but it's found in the Fratelli folder. And my description, having listened to most of it, does not match any other description of this program. So I don't know what this is. Maybe we got the wrong date. What? It's the one we're going to hear. Oh, we don't have time for Manfred Mann. I'm sorry. Take it, Gene. WBAI New York.
Cha-cha-cha-cha. I don't know what to do about it tonight. I feel very bashful tonight. Cha-cha. Well, I do. You know, there are nights when you feel more sensitive than other nights. You prefer to sit over and hide under the air conditioner. Cha-cha-cha-cha-cha. It's a terrible thing here when you're a performer. You know, it's not easy to go on as Hamlet. And, you know, when you're out there and you're on the stage and you're saying to be or not to be, that's the question. And there's a little voice that says, oh, what the hell, who cares? You know, you just can't do that. Cha-cha-cha-cha-cha. A very terrible person sometimes. I ain't Art Linkletter. Cha-cha-cha-cha. My show is not called Children Are Funny, but kids can be drags. Let's see, we've got to carry on here on this radio station. Of course, we believe in true public spirit and keeping you abreast of the fast-moving developments of our world, letting you know just what's happening in this fantastic gallimaufry, the incredible merry-go-round in which we find ourselves. So, first of all, tonight we have news of the world of erotica. Would you please bring me some belly-thumping music, please? We're keeping you abreast of what's happening throughout the world. I have just received a note from one of our spies who sent me a clipping from a newspaper up in Canada. Things are swinging in Canada. There are a lot of belly dancers working up there, and I see one of the newest big hit belly dancers up there is Charmaine de Gaulle. She performs in a four-star general's uniform. With a big FFI across her chest. Well, there's another one here, Jamie Bond. It's a large buxom blonde. I think the greatest one, I think they really make it big here in town, is a new belly dancer that's working up in Toronto named LBJ. It's E-L-B-E-E-J-A-Y, and she has a red, white, and blue G-string. She wears a big 10-gallon hat, too. Oh, wow. Imagine when they mouse a tongue. I'm not inventing this. Everybody looks at me like I'm inventing it. You can't invent life. It's wilder than that. You just can't invent it. I don't care how far afield you go. You know, I do a lot of writing, and you sit there. You just can't invent anything that's greater than what's really happening. Like the other night, I'm watching television, and I'm sitting there, you know, I'm waiting for the late movie or something. And you know how they come on with this little card that says, Tonight's Adventure? And then they follow it with a, you know, with a thing of what the movie's going to be. And it came on, it says, Tonight's Adventure. There was a pause, and it went to black. And then out came a thing, it says, Fly to Birmingham via Delta. What the heck? If you know anything about Birmingham, it could be an adventure, I'll tell you that. Sorry for a lot of people. You know, speaking of, you just couldn't invent it anymore. I'm sitting there in the barber shop, picking my teeth and waiting for my turn. And you know, there's certain papers you don't think, you think they play it straight, like the Times. You figure the Times is not putting you on. And there's an ad in the Times that says, the American bidet is wonderful. Well, now, I just hope a lot of you look at me with a funny look in your eye that you don't know what it is. That's okay. If you don't know, I'm not going to be the first to tell you. It's spelled B-I-D-E-T. And don't get mad at me. I'm reading to you right out of the New York Times, and that's official, so don't come back. It says, it's an ad. It says, the American bidet is wonderful. From a recognized continental custom, an ingenious new American product. And it goes on to talk about this fantastic new American bidet, and says, yes, it's a European custom that really goes all the way. It says, why not try it for 1 week? And then, that's all right. I'm glad you're not getting it. That's okay with me. Those that are getting it are going to enjoy it. Directly, oh, yeah, there's some things that are a little level above your poor little klutzy mind. And it has all this about the American bidet, and then right underneath it, exactly underneath that ad. Now, I don't know whether somebody in the Times was really being hip. and really needling the upper echelon, or whether it was an unconscious Freudian slip. Right underneath this whole ad about the bidet is a little note that says, C.L. Sulzberger writes on foreign affairs from Paris. Now, if you don't know what I'm talking about, you look it up. It's spelled B-I-D-E-T. I'm just wild about Harry, and Harry's wild about me. Oh, you just can't beat real life. Would you please bring me my newsreel music? Wouldn't it be great if they had newscasts that really had the kind of news that you really want to hear about? Instead of all this stuff about a guy makes a speech, another politician starts a committee to investigate the speech that the first politician gave, and then another politician gives a speech attacking the committee that the third politician started to investigate the first politician's speech in hoc agricula conc ad absurdum. Please bring on my news. Well, now, the eyes and the ears of the world are upon you. Here, there, and everywhere, the great Seeing Eye camera brings you news of the world, views of the world, the way the world is spinning today. And now, here he is, H.G. Grubber, at tonight's news. And now, here he is, speaking to you from Hessville, Indiana, our foreign correspondent, H.L. Grubbage.
Good evening. Good evening, Americans, everywhere.
Look at him, fella.
Cha-cha-cha-cha-cha. I kind of like this. Well, can you just see yourself sitting there with your slack jaw watching the newsreel, and you see all these soldiers marching, the guys doing calisthenics, you know? The cameraman grinding with his hat on backwards. Cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha.
Flood, mass flood waters swept down the Ohio River Valley today. Thousands were left homeless in the wake of the churning flood waters. Red Cross officials say that it will be days before all the survivors are brought ashore from the tops of the chicken houses. As we look now, we can see vast trees being swept down, downstream under the great press of the Father of Waters, flood waters sweeping over America.
It's down to sunny Florida, where Miss Orange Pip was nominated for 1966. Whoops, my dear. You see that the newest fashions are being displayed here, along with Clido, who is wearing false eyelashes. And there we see Lily Deschaux now on the top high 7-meter board as she is about to display the new feather fashions from the Lily Deschaux fashions in Paris. My dear. Oh, you see what I mean. Now, wouldn't it be just great, though, if they really had the... Here, now, here, let's do a little practice newscast of the kind of news that tells more about our world. Just set it from the beginning there, huh? All set? Oh, here we go now. See, I get carried away by my old jazz. And now, here we go with News of the World. People in action everywhere, here, there, and everywhere around the globe. First, from the foreign front, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Joseph Nariri, brother of Tanzania's president, has found a dramatic way of demonstrating to villagers of Urakiwi Island in Lake Victoria what moshi, their home-brewed spirit, can do to their insides. Nariri, the regional commissioner, recently dipped a goat's liver into a bowl of moshi, shown on the screen now, then pulled it out completely bleached white. Moshi has been blamed for 36 deaths on the island in the last year. The natives continue to drink it. And now, news of married life in America. Barber David Schrock of Dallas, Texas, refuses to give businessmen a crew cut unless the customer brings a note of permission from his wife in writing and signed. A
again from the foreign front. A 60-year-old Zambian villager has five wives and is looking around for more, the information department said today. The department said that the man had 15 wives and four concubines until a year ago. But one wife died, nine divorced him, and all the concubines left. Asked why he had so many wives, the villager replied, "I always feel sorry for unmarried women."
I like the idea of nine simultaneous divorces. Here we have here another news note from here, there, and everywhere. From Ottawa, for reasons not yet adequately explained, Canadians are the world's most nervous people when they come within range of a telephone. International statistics for 1965, just released, show that for the 12th consecutive year, Canadians use their telephones more often than any other people. They made, on an average, 597.7 telephone calls per person throughout the entire nation of Canada during the year. The fact that Iceland comes second with an average of 574.9 calls, the United States is a very poor third. Didn't know that, did you? They're very nervous up there around Toronto. I mean, with LBJ doing all that stripping up there. Charmaine de Gaulle. Now, you want to hear some more of these? Now, here, there, and everywhere. You want to hear some more? Right, let's see. Here's one. Would you please give me my ghost music? No. Set it up in there. No, it's all right. Don't worry. We got plenty of time. Right, let me handle that, okay? I'm just... immediately following the next few little bits and pieces, I'm going to give you a little cue of what's about to happen here. Would you please bring that on? We're going to visit the world of the deep down, inside, swirling, murky waters of the scariness part of our life. It's all right, baby. It's okay. I will let you hang there by your thumbs. And while you're doing that, speaking of the scared again, this is WOR AM and FM in New York Town. Please hit the button there.
The New York Times has no Hollywood gossip column, but it does give you something that's much more interesting. Real news of movies and the people who make them. Here's Peter Bart, Times reporter in Hollywood.
The job of writing about movies out here is to find the important things that are happening, which might be interesting to the more literate moviegoer. Now, this doesn't mean you have to wait for a professor to write a screenplay before you do a story. I may cover a social event that is typically Hollywood, because the Times reader wants an objective view of the humorous, lotus-eating sort of stuff, as well as the elements of art that you get in the cinema. But generally what I try to do is to write about movies being made that are of more than routine interest.
That's the New York Times. If you're without it, you're not with it. For home delivery, call Murray Hill 70700. That's MU70700.
I know I'm going to be very unpopular with the guys at the Times, but my suggestion to you is that any critic who calls movies cinema, be careful. I'll tell you, one of the worst things that ever happened to the movie world was when it became called cinema. Then look out. It was very, you know what I'm talking about, Christ. Speaking of, do you have some more of those little things in there? Oh, boy, this commercial world, wow.
The bright, clear taste in beer.
Radio do without
Miller
beer.
High Life, the champagne of bottle beer.
Baseball will be out of business. No more
That's
football.
Miller games. High Life.
What would people do without beer?
The happy sound is about famous Miller High Life beer that has soared in popularity because millions more recognize the traditional quality and heritage of an unequaled, unchanging, truly great beer. Wherever people are living better, you'll find Miller High Life in handy take-home cans, on tap, or in the familiar crystal clear bottles. Next time you want the very finest, ask for Miller High Life, the champagne of bottle beer. Sparkling, flavorful, distinctive.
You can get beer-flavored gum now. Did you hear that? Yeah. You can also get beer-flavored toothpaste. I'm sure, who'd want that? I don't know. Boy, nothing tastes greater than about a three-day-old taste of beer. Well, that's one of the great human feelings. You know that? Yeah. He. Kabbalah. Oh, let's get on with some of these commercials here. An important name to remember, if you like to enjoy the luxury of a made-to-measure suit, is Woolmuth. W-O-H-L-M-U-T-H. It's America's largest made-to-measure clothing specialist. For about the same amount of money that you'd spend for ready-made, you know, off-the-gas-pipe rack suits, all that junk. For about the same amount of money, Woolmuth will help you design clothes that do more for you. If you really have bad taste, listen, these guys will make you the worst-looking guy in town. I mean, it's up to you, you know. In other words, they give you free rein. They just don't control you at all. And they'll make them to your exact measurements in your choice of over 1,500 fabrics. They let you decide on the length of your jacket. You can have it hanging down by your ankles, the shape of your shoulders and lapels. You can even look like Tony Curtis, you know, with those fantastic white shoulders on. Whew, worst dresser in the Western world. Even the taper of your trousers, you can decide on that. A Woolmuth made-to-measure suit is made to fit your personality. Can you imagine how awful it would be if you had a suit that fit your personality? Seriously? You walking around the street with that gorilla suit? Yeah. With the green fur on it? The fin coming out the back? That's Woolmuth, custom tailor and shirt maker. And there's a Woolmuth store at 3143 Steinway Street in Astoria, Queens. Another at 52 Market in Newark, New Jersey. Button, please. Hit it there. Oh, you don't have the Times? Oh, we've done the Times. That's right. That was the guy with the cinema jazz. Oh, we have one more. Rover. Oh, hey, speaking of the Times, there was a big ad in the current, this morning's issue of the New York Times about the Rover. And a lot of stuff about the new design and the safety design and so on of the Rover 2000. And if you didn't see that ad, and you happen to be about to write to us for a picture of the Rover, they will also include a copy of that ad, which has a lot of details taken by a big testing laboratory about the Rover in actual conditions. You know that there are many automobile companies here in America today who are studying the Rover 2000. It is genuinely one of the most advanced cars in the world. A beautiful machine. And if you're planning for a car for this summer, I would suggest the Rover. Incidentally, if you buy a Rover, you can forget buying another car for about 8 or 9 years. This car is made to be on the scene. It is not like costume jewelry. Rover 2000. And if you'd like to get a picture of it, send us a postcard, address it to Costume Jewelry here at WOR 1440 Broadway, New Yorkie, please.
My name doesn't matter. Let's just say I'm a highly paid executive of the Luden's Company. I must report to you that our campaign to discourage people from chewing Luden's cough drops...
Listen for these great noises. Now, listen.
We have tried every way we know to get you chewers to dissolve Luden's cough drops slowly so the medication can trickle down slowly to give you temporary relief from coughs due to colds and minor sore throat. What can we do to make you understand? Should we engineer Luden's cough drops so that they make embarrassing sounds when you chew one, like this? Should we publish the names of known chewers? Those of you out there who chew Luden's cough drops, please write us your suggestions. Address your letter to me, Mr. X, the Luden's Never Chew Society, Luden's, Reading, Pennsylvania.
See, I can do them. Again. You know, speaking of cough drops, you just listen to that spot, you don't think much about it. But did you ever have a mother who used to really raise Cain with you, though, when you would do that? You'd chew your cough drops? Has that ever happened to you? Oh, my mother used to scream like bloody murder. You know, I've got a cold. When I had a cold, of course, I had the mother type who believed strongly in the Argyle sock treatment. And that she would tie an Argyle sock around my neck with about 7.5 pounds of Vicks that she would rub into my Adam's apple. And then once in a while, when I really had a real rotten cold, I mean, a really crummy cold, And I'm a kid, you know, and I can't breathe, and my nose is all stuffed up. I can, do you, speaking of life's little genuine victories that are never sung about, nobody writes poems about them, the little secret, fantastic moments of great victory and relief or whatever it might be in our little lives, our little crummy, grumbling lives, nobody has ever written a poem about how it feels after about 5 days of a fantastic cold and your nose is stopped up, and it's stopped up all the way down into your ankles, you know, packed in there like concrete. And your eyes are all swollen and bugged out. And, you know, your nose feels like a big potato just hanging on the front of your face. And your ears, there's a humming sound in your ears. And then after about 5 days of that, and you're constantly, you can't breathe. You're talking like this, girl. And after about 5 days of this, you grab a Kleenex or a handkerchief, and you go, and it really works. You know that great moment of blowing your nose and you really score? Now, it may sound like I'm talking, no, it's not bad taste. I'm talking about little, genuine, walking around life, and nobody ever writes a poem on the great nose blow. You know? And another one of the little secret successes of the human body, of this walking around corporeal creature that we are, is when you get the sneeze and it actually comes out. I've always wondered about people who kill sneezes. I wonder if there's been any Freudian psychologists who have worked on the kind of a personality of the person who will never leave his sneeze come out, you know, who goes, you know, that kind. Oh, what a... I always want to say, oh, come on, let me sneeze it for you. I like to sneeze, you know. And sometimes, oh, I'll go for 3 or 4 weeks and work on a sneeze. It's in the way in the back, see? And it comes forward a little bit, and then it recedes. Then I feel cheated. Oh, I lost it. It's like getting a nibble when you're fishing, and it's not biting again. And then it comes forward again. Then it recedes. And I've got all kinds of little tricks. Like, for example, I think clean thoughts when I'm trying to bring a sneeze on. I said they're real. And I think of fields of waving daffodils and lakes and trees and streams and the sunshine. And then when I'm really desperate, you know, sometimes you can bring a, it's like bringing a pimple to the head. You know, everybody's looking. Sometimes you can do it by looking right into a light bulb. Have you ever done that? You look right into a light bulb and here it comes. Come on, baby, come on. Damn it. Then you go back to reading some crummy junk. You're looking at you. You're looking at Earl Wilson or something. You sit there. Oh, gee. Oh, here it comes again. Deep down inside of you, your soul feels, oh, wow, great. Plaisir. Oh, man. You know, speaking of fire, you have my little ghost thing there. Once in a great while, I read to you out of the great annals of terrible poetry. You know, people miss this point. I've always felt that really bad poetry is the purest of camp, the absolute purest. And every time I read poems, I'll get 45 letters from people who say, please, Shepard, why don't you really do something great and really get on the stick and really do something fantastic. Read Dylan Thomas. Why don't you really get on there and read Wordsworth and really do something with, you know. All right. You want to hear some really rotten poetry? Do you like to hear a little rotten poetry tonight on this rotten, crummy night, huh? I can't get LBJ out of my mind with the red, white, and blue G-string. I can hear her music. Can't you hear it? With tom-toms. And the guy's got they got tom-toms going and red lights playing. And they're playing a tom-tom version of the Stars and Stripes Forever or Hail to the Chief. Bring me a little scary music. I don't know what's the matter with me tonight. I'm in one of them moods. Is this the kind of show you like when I'm in one of those rotten moods? Wow, jeez. Holy smokes. wait a minute. Listen, I am not in the bidet selling business. I read an ad out of the Times. Forget it. Wouldn't it be awful if we got some great commercials like that? Well, look, whoever's sitting out there and they heard me talk about this American bidet that was advertised in the Times, so it must be all right. It's all right. It's official, so don't get mad at me. Anybody who has a dictionary there, we have an entire staff of very innocent people sitting in the control room. You have no idea how innocent and how provincial people can be in this great, wild, swirling city that has often been called America's Babylon. Would one of you please call up if you have a dictionary and give a definition out of the dictionary to my little staff member sitting there of what a bidet is. And while you're doing that, please bring my spooky music. Now, you want to hear it? Oh, this is a ghost story. A ghost story entitled, give me a little echo chamber. The Fall of J.W. Bean. All right, I'll tell you what. Every time I go like that, give me the echo chamber, okay? In all the Eastern Hemisphere, you wouldn't find a knight, a peer, a viscount, an earl or baronet, a marquis or a duke, nor yet a prince or emperor or king or sultan, czar, or anything that could in family pride surpass J. Wentworth Bean of Boston, Mass. His family tree could far outscale the beanstalk in the fairy tale, and Joseph's coat would pale before the blazoned coat of arms he bore, the arms of his old ancestor, one Godfrey Bean, who, crossed, you know, about 200 years ago. He had it stamped, engraved, embossed, without the least regard to cost, upon his house, upon his gate, upon his tablecloth, his plate, upon his knocker, and his hat, his mat, upon his watch, inside his hatband, on a scarf pin, handkerchief, and screen, on cards. In short, J. Wentworth Bean contrived to have old Godfrey's crest on everything that he possessed. And lastly, when he died, his will proved to contain a codicil directing that a sum be spent to carve it on his monument. But if you think this ends the scene, you little know J. Wentworth Bean. To judge him by the common host is reckoning without his ghost. And it is something that befell his ghost that tonight I chiefly have to tell. At midnight, now listen carefully, at midnight of the very day they laid J. Wentworth Bean away, no sooner had the clock come round to 12 p.m. than from the ground arose a specter, lank and lean, with a frigid air and a haughty mien. No other than J. Wentworth Bean, unchanged in all, except his pride, if anything, intensified. He looked about him with that air of supercilious despair that very stuck-up people wear at some society affair when no one in their set is there. Then, after brushing from his sleeves bits of mold and clinging leaves and lightly dusting off his shoe, the iron gate he floated through, just looking back the clock to note, as one who fears to miss a boat. Yes, he floated out of the cemetery. The ghost of J. Wentworth Bean. 10 minutes later, found him on the ghost's Cunarder, the ghost steamship, Oregon. And 10 days later, by spook time, he heard the hour of midnight chime from out of the tower of Beanley Hall, and stood within the graveyard wall beside a stone, moss-grown and green, on which these simple words were seen. In memory, Sir Godfrey Bean. The while he gazed in thought serene, a little ghost of humble mien, unkempt and crooked, bent and spare, A tiny ghost accosted him with cringing air.
Most noble sir, tis plain to see that you are not of the likes of me. You are a spook of high degree.
My good man,
cried J. Wentworth Bean.
Leave me a little while, I pray. I have traveled very far today, and I desire to be alone with him who sleeps beneath this stone. I cannot rest until I have seen my ancestor, my noble ancestor, Sir Godfrey Bean.
Your ancestor? How can that be?
Exclaimed the little ghost.
When he, the last of his line, was drowned at sea 200 years ago, this stone is to his memory alone. I and I only saw his end. And he, my master and my friend, leaned o'er the vessel's side one night. I pushed him. No, it was not right. I own that I was much to blame. I donned his clothes and I took the name of Bean. I also took his gold, about $5,000 all told. And so to Boston, Massachusetts, I came to found a family and a name. I, in former times, had been Sir Godfrey's.
Wretch! What do you mean?
Sir Godfrey's what?
Gasp. Wentworth Bean.
I was Sir Godfrey's valet. His humble manservant.
That same night when the ghost steamer sailed, you might among the passengers have seen the ghost, a very abject mien. Faded and shrunk, forlorn and frayed, the shadow of his former shade, who registered now in steerage class, J.W. Bean of Boston, Mass. Now, gentle reader, do not try to guess the family which I disguise as Bean. Enough that they exist on Beacon Hill today. In sweet enjoyment of their claims, it is not well to mention names. Okay. We will not even mention. By the way, did you see the movie that was on television? Speaking of great movies, how many of you caught that fantastic movie that was on television last night, The Long and the Short and the Tall? Did you see that movie? There were some of the greatest lines I have ever seen come off of a movie screen came out of that one last night. You mean to tell me you didn't see that? Isn't it funny? Everybody's over there watching the official channels, and on the unofficial channel is a great movie. Yeah, there was one scene. It was all about these Australian soldiers. There was one scene where this Australian soldier was lying in his bunk, and they were in the middle of Japanese country, territory. They were behind the lines, and the rain is banging down, and he is reading a lady magazine. Did you read that one? And he says, "Aye, mates. Look at this, mates. Here's a column here, mates. It's about this broad, you know, this bimbo who answers all the questions of all the other bimbos who write and say, I've had a little trouble with a corporal, and I'd like to know what I can do about it. Now, listen to this question here, mates. I'm in love with a corporal. And I would love to know what to do. You see, he has been making improper suggestions, and I would like to make him my husband, but I don't know what to do because of those improper suggestions. Mites, what do you think she gets as a way of a bit of information there, a bit of advice?" And all the others are sitting around there saying, "What? What's the advice?" It's, "Well, here's what it says. It says, first of all, I believe I'm sorry that you are in love with a corporal. I would suggest you give him the knee in the crotch, and then I would suggest..." I thought to myself, holy smokes, you just can't imagine that coming out. I mean, it was just so beautifully, so realistically written, just exactly the way GIs talk. And there it was. Did you see the little scene where the Japanese soldier? Oh, I won't even go into that. There's a lot. You know, speaking of great movies, how many of you are a fan of another movie that makes the rounds all the time? You see it about every 5 years, and it's the late George Apley. You ever see that movie with Ronald Coleman? Every time I see it, I hear more lines in it that are more relevant to today than even in the days when I first... It was on TV a couple of nights ago. And this book... Now, I'm not such a great Jay Marquand fan at all. But I think of all the books, that was the first book that I read as a kid that was a book of social commentary. Up to that time, you know, I was reading stuff like Captain Blood. Did you ever read Captain Blood stuff by Raphael Sabatini? And I was reading things like Jack London books, and I read stuff like The Outdoor Chums at the Lake and that kind of stuff. How I happened to come across that book, I have no idea. I think some teacher gave it to me or something. But I found myself one day reading the late George Apley. Can you imagine somebody living in Hessville, Indiana, who's about 12 years old, reading the late George Apley about the Boston Brahmin Society? I had no concept. To me, Boston was a place where the Boston Braves came from, you know, and they were where Ted Williams played out of. You know, my idea of Boston was the Boston Red Sox. I knew that Boston just meant nothing to me. But I started to read this book, and I can recall the first scene. The first scene in the book was George Apley, this very elegant Bostonian, looking out of the window of his home, and he's looking through the curtains, this very elegant home, and it's nighttime, and he sees a Coca-Cola sign flashing off and on, and he is fantastically indignant. Oh boy, is he indignant. The whole world is going to hell. They've got a Coca-Cola sign and it's shining down on the commons, and he is sitting down and he is writing an indignant letter to the mayor or something about the fact that they've got a Coca-Cola sign now, and you can see the neon and it's shining on the trees in Boston. And here I'm a kid, you see, and living in the middle of a town who thought Coca-Cola signs were beautiful. Our idea of a fantastically beautiful thing was to go and drive 40 miles to look at the Coca-Cola signs. You know, that kind of stuff. My old man used to say, did you see the great new neon sign down at the Bluebird Tavern? And people would all go down and look at the new neon sign. They had a neon sign that was outlined in red, and it had blue wings, and it was the kind that clicked off and on with two wings going up and down. It looked like it was flying, and above it said Bluebird. And everyone went down there, you know, applauded the new sign. Speaking of, don't call in. We've got 422 definitions of, so forget it now. We're all set now. Everybody is disillusioned in the control room, and they're all confused. One other one, you know, speaking of that peculiar world of slobism of which I grew out of and am still part of, I wonder how it must feel to have grown up in a family of exquisite sensibilities. I know that nobody up here knows that, but I'm seriously asking, have you wondered, though, about how it must have felt to grow up in a family that really did have an elegant house and had elegant people that would come in and would talk about books, and they read the Evergreen Review, and they all were of the class of Eckstein something from Harvard or Yale, and they spoke of their fraternities and their sororities. I just wonder how it would feel to have been born in a world like that and then find yourself out in the real world. I mean, the real world. You know what I suspect? I suspect that these are the people who are behind the entire movement of camp. That they now, at a certain point in their life, they've come out of elegance. Most of them have, you know. People, Thomas Wolfe and all these people, the Yale, the whole Upper East Side of New York, elegant society, J.D. Salinger world. And now suddenly, in 1966, they have discovered things like the Mets. And they discovered things like bad movies, the stuff that they would never have gone to and their family would never have tolerated when they were kids. Do you see what I'm saying? And that's a great new discovery, and it's fascinating to see people at the age of 35 all of a sudden discovering Superman, all of a sudden discovering Batman, and they come out of families who would never have allowed them to have Batman at home when they were kids. They would have had something like Lord Fauntleroy, or they would have been reading the life of the young Shakespeare, at home. And Winnie the Pooh, that's what they would have been reading at home. And things like The Wind and the Willows. And they had a nanny that read to them selections from, but very carefully selected, from Alice in Wonderland, that kind of stuff. And all the rest of us grew up with Batman, so we're not gassed over it. You know, what is this Batman jazz? You know, I grew up in a family whose idea of a fantastic Thanksgiving dinner was 12 White Castle cheeseburgers. I mean, that was really a big night to go out. You remember, go out and get a bag of those things and sit in the Oldsmobile and stuff your face with them? I had a listen, I grew up with a father who drank ketchup right out of the bottle. And so for most of America, I suspect, the stuff that everybody is talking about, this camp, you know, bad Ginger Rogers movies and the old crummy Johnny Weissmuller movies and all this stuff, we just took it so much for granted that it's not a matter of rediscovery at this day and age. It's a matter of, oh, I've had it, you know, you're tired. But a lot of people are just discovering this for the first time and, by the way, becoming nostalgic over it. Just like, oh, well, this is all part of the caste society, you know. Oh, yeah, it goes right back. I wonder if anybody has pointed out as camp, as a caste, an upper caste societal element of our time. Yeah, no, it reminds me of the back to nature movement of the French court, the Rousseauian naturalist movement, when Madame Pompadour and the whole crowd would go out back of the palace at Versailles and play like their nursemaids. Yeah, they discovered the world of the peasants, you see, and they went back there and played like they were peasants, and they made a whole big shtick, you know, milking cows and shoveling up behind the horses and all that stuff. It was all done with high elegance, of course, and done for fun, you see, and they could always go back to the castle, of course, immediately after it got a little bit of a drag, you know. They didn't have to stay out there and do all the stuff. And I'm reminded of a great deal of that in the world of the camp, that it's people who never really were part of that scuddy, crummy world. You know, the world where the highest form of literature was Maggie and Jiggs. Oh, that was the only reading that was ever done in the house, you know? The Katzenjammer Kids, you know, that kind of stuff. Oh, sure, a big folk hero in our world was B.Z. Binks. Yeah, he hung around the Sugar Bowl with old Pop Jenks and that whole crowd, you know? Lillums and Harold Teen. And we used to go down, well, I'll tell you one of the biggest things we used to do, speaking of camp, we didn't know it was camp. They had a lunch wagon in our neighborhood, and it was built by the airport. And the lunch wagon was the greatest lunch wagon I ever saw. Even today, if there was one like this, it would make $1 billion. The lunch wagon was the body of an airplane. The guy had bought an old crashed airplane and had set up all the seats, and you'd come right into the airplane. It was a crashed Fokker triplane, and they used to call it the Fokker triplane, was the name of the joint there. And everyone would go and sit there and eat hamburgers and cheeseburgers and drink Yoo-Hoo, you know, right in the middle of an airplane that would crash. Talk about camp, man.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news. Send a pair of Rambler Americans to the 1966 Pure Oil Performance Tests, and wow, listen to this. In the acceleration test, Rambler American finished a perfect 1-2, out-hustling all the competition in Class 6. Where did the American's new muscle come from? From the newest, biggest, most powerful Standard 6 engine in its class. As for that traditional Rambler economy, it was there as usual. Even with automatic transmission, Rambler American delivered a remarkable 24.5 miles per gallon in the economy test. Now for the real clincher. With all this performance, all this economy, Rambler American 220 is still the lowest list priced car made in the USA. You heard right, the lowest. Stop by at your friendly American Motors Rambler dealer for an eye-opening test drive right now. Stay tuned now for Lester Smith and all the late news from the WOR newsroom. This is WOR AM and FM, your RKO general station in New York. See Audrey Hepburn, Shirley MacLaine, James Garner, and Miriam Hopkins in the New York television premiere of The Children's Hour, Sunday night at 7:30 on the Big Preview on WOR TV, Channel 9. It's 11 o'clock. Good evening, 11 o'clock, Thursday, February 24th. This is Lester Smith in the WOR newsroom with all the latest news, late sports, stocks, and weather. And this late story, sources close to the National Council of Churches claim tonight that White House pressure had resulted in the watering down of a policy statement that would have been critical of administration policy in Vietnam. The sources said the calls had been made earlier this week by White House aide Bill Moyers
in an attempt to stop the outright endorsement of a resolution passed last week by the World Council of Churches, which called for an immediate ceasefire in Vietnam and United States recognition that there is a social revolution in Vietnam that could be better settled by the Vietnamese. New York City residents can just about resign themselves to a city income tax and an increase in the city real estate tax if the state legislature will approve them. Mayor Lindsay will go to Albany on Sunday to brief members of the state legislature on the various tax options included in the Lindsay tax program for New York City to meet budget deficits estimated at $412 million for the current fiscal year and more than $600 million for fiscal 66-67. City Hall sources reported that the mayor will tell the legislature that a city income tax is essential and that unless an increase in the real estate tax is granted, he will have to increase subway and bus fares. Two New York City Republicans.
Wow, shades of current budgeting here in New York City. Well, we're running over. I guess we'll run a little bit into Jimmy Dore's time. Just long enough for me to say thanks for listening and good night. This has been the Dustbin of History. That was Gene Shepherd and Lester Smith confirmed February 24th. I'm assuming 1966. That's it. Good night. Thanks for tuning in. We're out of here.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Did I mention I'm your curator and janitor, Max Mead? Goodbye. Yeah.
That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal. Well, I'm going to come back.
All right, it's 2 a.m.